All right. So let's open up in prayer, and then we'll get started. Let's pray. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for this morning. We pray your blessing on this church and on the people in the church, in the town of Hollywood, the city of Hollywood, and Los Angeles that we minister to. Please allow us to be instruments of your grace. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, thank you all for coming. I'm going to begin in Genesis 37, which we have now started five different times. But I'm going to read through it just from verses 2 to 36. Again, you'll have heard some of this, but we're going to focus on the part that we haven't focused on yet. So just listen again to this, and I think I may there's Van Gogh. And then here we go. This is the account of Jacob's descendants. Joseph was 17 years old and tended the flock with his brothers. While he was helping the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives, Joseph told their father unflattering things about them. Now, Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other sons because he was born when Jacob was old. Jacob had made for him a long robe, and when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than any of his brothers, they hated him, couldn't even talk nicely to him. Joseph had a dream and told it to his brothers, which made them hate him even more. He said to them, "Listen to this dream I had. When we were binding stalks of grain in the field, my stalk got up and stood upright while your stalks gathered around it and bowed down to my stalk." His brothers said to him, "Will you really be our king and rule over us?" So they hated him even more because of the dreams he told them. Then Joseph had another dream, and he described it to his brothers. "I've just dreamed again, and this time the sun and the moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me." And when he described it to his father and brothers, his father scolded him and said to him, "What kind of dreams have you dreamed? Am I and your mother and your brother supposed to come and bow down to the ground in front of you?" His brothers were jealous of him, but his father took careful note of the matter. So we're reading a slightly different translation today. Joseph's brothers went to tend their father's flocks near Shechem. Israel said to Joseph, "Aren't your brothers tending the sheep near Shechem? Come, I'll send you to them." And he said, "I'm ready." So Jacob said to him, "Go, find out how your brothers are and how the flock is and report back to me." So Jacob sent him from the Hebron Valley. And when he approached Shechem, a man found him wandering the field and asked him, "What are you looking for?" Joseph said, "I'm looking for my brothers. Tell me, where are they tending the sheep?" The man said, "They left here. I heard them saying, 'Let's go to Dothan.'" So Joseph went after his brothers and found them in Dothan. They saw Joseph in the distance before he got close to them, and they plotted to kill him. The brothers said to each other, "Here comes the big dreamer. Come on, let's kill him and throw him into one of the cisterns, and we'll say a wild animal devoured him. Then we will see what becomes of his dreams." When Reuben heard what they said, he saved him from them, telling them, "Let's not take his life." Reuben said to them, "Don't spill his blood. Throw him into this desert cistern, but don't lay a hand on him." He intended to save Joseph from them and take him back to his father. When Joseph reached his brothers, they stripped off Joseph's long robe, took him and threw him into the cistern, an empty cistern with no water in it. When they sat down to eat, they looked up and saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with camels carrying sweet resin, medicinal resin, and fragrant resin on their way down to Egypt. Judah said to his brothers, "What do we gain if we kill our brother and hide his blood? Come on, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites. Let's not harm him because he's our brother. He's family." His brothers agreed. When some Midianite traders passed by, they pulled Joseph up out of the cistern. They sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver, and they brought Joseph to Egypt. When Reuben returned to the cistern and found that Joseph wasn't in it, he tore his clothes. Then he returned to his brothers and said, "The boy's gone, and where can I go now?" His brothers took Joseph's robe, slaughtered a male goat, dipped the robe in the blood. They took the long robe, brought it to their father, and said, "We found this. See, it's your son's. See if it's your son's robe or not." Jacob recognized it and said, "It is my son's robe. A wild animal has devoured him. Joseph must have been torn to pieces." Then Jacob tore his clothes, put a simple mourning cloth around his waist, and mourned for his son for many days. All of his sons and daughters got up to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted, telling them, "I'll go to my grave mourning for my son." And Joseph's father wept for him. Meanwhile, the Midianites had sold Joseph to the Egyptians, to Potiphar, Pharaoh's chief officer, commander of the royal guard. So there's the first part of the Joseph story, and we've now read that whole section, the first section of Joseph and his brothers. And as I was thinking about it for this week, it occurred to me, you know, that what Joseph's brothers hate so much about Joseph isn't that he's a dreamer, but that he's a prophet. That's the thing they can't stand. And the Hebrew here actually points to this. The Hebrew word, typically translated dreamer, I learned this from Gerhard von Rott this week, means much more than our English word, he writes. Namely, it means the one empowered to prophetic dreams. So here's an important point that would be lost if we just read the English translation. They don't despise their brother because their brother's a dreamer. I mean, they may despise their brother because he's loved more by the father than anyone else, but the reason they really grow to hate him is because of his dreams, his dream prophecies. And one of the points that I think is important for us to think about when we're looking at this is that the point, one of these points is that no one likes a know-it-all, right? No one likes to be around someone who often is telling us things we don't want to hear. I mean, and typically, or often at least, when we talk about a know-it-all, what we mean is a truth teller. We don't like someone often to tell us the truth. And this is a clear tension that's happening between the brothers and Joseph here. That the brothers are not comfortable with what Joseph is telling them, and it's not because he's making things up, but it's because he's telling the truth, and they don't like the truth. It's an inconvenient truth. It's an uncomfortable truth. They're not interested in hearing about this, and I see this happening, and you see this, I'm sure, happening too, when pastors get up in front of the congregation and have some bad news to share. A lot of times the congregation doesn't want to hear it. They're not interested in the bad news. They want to just, you know, essentially move on, and they don't want to hear about it. And what's interesting about Joseph's brothers, and I'm trying to paint a picture here of people who aren't just merely jealous, these brothers, of the father's love, but they're pretty bad dudes. I mean, they're not very nice. They're not really good people. I mean, notice they lie to their father. So they're not just cruel to Joseph, they're cruel to Jacob. They lie to the father and make up this story about Joseph being torn apart. These are not good men, with a couple of exceptions. Reuben tries to be a decent guy. We get the sense that Benjamin maybe isn't in on all of this. But I thought about this, and it becomes a slightly different take when you think of Joseph as a prophet rather than as a dreamer. Prophets, you know, are not taken in by the people around them. You know, a prophet isn't welcome even in his own city, especially in his own city. No one likes a prophet. And I thought about this. A prophet is basically the world's whistleblower. It's sort of outing the world. It's outing the community they happen to be in and saying, you know what? Things aren't what they should be. Things aren't right. And, you know, we don't like whistleblowers. We threaten whistleblowers. We threaten to kill them We threaten to throw them in jail. They are not people that are well liked. And I thought about this too, and I've read this somewhere also, that the 11 stars could have represented for the ancient readers the 11 signs of the zodiac. Meaning that the world is in on this. The cosmos, in other words, the planet, the stars, it's like we need to listen to the planet. We need to listen to nature. It has a story to tell. This is general revelation, which Presbyterians aren't always very good about. But in this case, Joseph seems to be saying, yeah, I'm telling you the truth, but I'm not the only one telling you the truth. The whole world, the cosmos, the stars, we're all telling you the truth. And again, right, it's hard to miss the contemporary message it may have for us today. The world is speaking to us right now. The planet Earth is speaking to us. The stars are speaking to us. It's this kind of intense cosmic conspiracy. And I find it interesting how the juxtaposition of this cosmic prophecy, Joseph is a conduit for this prophecy, the dream of the stars. And what is the brother's response? Well, it's a response of hate. That word is very strong in the Hebrew. They hate his brother. Four times we hear this. They despise him so much they can't even talk to him nicely. Depending on the translation, either they can't talk to him nicely or they can't talk to him at all. They just can't stand him. And that word hate is key here, because speaking truth to power is never pleasant for those in power. No one in power likes a prophet, because a prophet's job is to upset the status quo, and those in power depend on the status quo for their power. So anytime a prophet comes to town, the one person who's not going to like the prophet, the whistleblower, is the person who's in charge. And the people who don't like the prophet are the people who gain from the status quo. Namely, us. Those of us in this class. Me. Right? We gain from the status quo. The status quo, for the most part, has been pretty good to all of us, with a few exceptions here and there, perhaps. And so Joseph's dream prophecies are so disturbing that even Jacob, one of the three patriarchs, he's troubled by this. And he has to think about this, and he's measuring it. He can't quite shake the news. Here's how von Rott puts it. Here is a sketch of an uncanny field of force, of inner emotions. He's talking about Jacob, Israel, over which stands the two dreams, pointing to a dark future. The old man can't get them out of his head. And I'll tell you why I find this encouraging. As you know, my mom and I have coffee every morning, and we talk about the state of the union, of the Bruner family, and of the world in general. And the Bruner family's fine, but the world in general is in a crap load of trouble. And so our coffees have been growing increasingly depressing. And I mean, not, you can't, I mean, it's depressing and my mother don't go together, you understand, but it's a weird mix of someone who's very enthusiastic and deeply depressed. No, but we talk about it, we share this, I mean, the world feels like it's falling apart. Everyone's lying to us, you know, and everywhere you look. And it didn't help that Jen and I went to see Dark Waters this weekend, because that's just another indication of people in power who don't like truth speaking to them. It seems like every industry is falling apart. No industry is innocent. We are all, it is just so depressing. Politically, we live in a politically depressing time. We live we feel like we've been bamboozled by the big corporations, by the people who created social media, by DuPont Chemical Company, who I will be lambasting a little bit later, by you know, the, all the, it, it's as if these large entities that stand to gain from the status quo are the ones who are actually killing us. They're the ones who are threatening our livelihoods. Some of us may make our livelihoods off of them, I suppose, but they're threatening the quality of our lives in the truest sense of that word. And so the old man can't get these dreams out of his head, and I'm reminded of my coffees with my mother. Neither one of us can get this out of our heads. It's depressing, and I'm sure you join us in this. It's hard sometimes to fall asleep. You feel a general sense of anxiety about the world. It just seems like, is anyone with any amount of integrity calling the shots? Or are we all just sort of victims? Now, Joseph is just the messenger. But if the message is disturbing enough, it's the messenger who catches the heat. Right? Just ask Martin Luther King, among many others down through history, who forfeited their lives for the sake of the truth. And we end this section that I just read with Jacob's sorrow, Jacob's sadness. He can't literally almost live with himself at the thought of his youngest son's death. And this, think about this, what we've been covering all year long, the motif of a father losing his son. It's becoming an incantation, right? Over and over and over, we're hearing this from Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. They're all these, it's these weird father-son relationships, and people are losing things. Again, von Rott puts it this way. At the end of this story, verse 36, right there, nothing further will be said about Jacob for a long time. Nothing further will be said about Jacob for about 15 chapters. There's this silence, kind of similar to the silence of the story of Abraham and Isaac. We never hear about it again in the rest of the Old Testament. And in the case of Jacob here, we just know it ends in this intense sorrow. And so von Rott writes, nothing further will be said about Jacob for a long time. The timeless veil of sorrow sinks over his life for many years. For many years, Jacob, Israel, is heartbroken. For many years, Jacob's veil of sorrow is worn. And there's another motif here again, and again, von Rott illuminated this for me, and he does for us. The beginning of Joseph's story, at the very beginning, at verses 1 and 2, is still under the shadow of Jacob's guilt. I loved being reminded of this week. You can never tell the story of a person without telling the story of their parents and their siblings. That each one of our stories is intimately connected to the story of our father and mother, of our caretaker. That you can't know a person simply by knowing them. And we know this when you get married, you don't just marry a person, you marry a family, right? You marry in. And so, von Rott writes, the beginning of Joseph's story is still under the shadow of Jacob's guilt, which had clung to the old man since his youth. Remember? Just as Jacob once deceived his father and robbed his brother, whom his father loved more than him, so now he is deceived by his sons, who have shoved his favorite son to one side. Oh, interesting. That's right, we forgot. Jacob was the illegitimate recipient of his father Isaac's blessing. Remember that? He got it unfairly. And now there's a little biblical kismet going on here. Suddenly he's the one now who has to mourn the death of a son who he loved most. And Jacob had robbed Isaac of his chance to bless the son he loved most. This is generational dysfunction at a biblical scale, right? There is, in other words, I think, going on in this story, a significant psychological element to this story, or a psycho-spiritual element, which traces the deeds of the fathers not merely to the sons, but through them. Right? Much of what we have to contend with in this life, you and I, are not of our own doing. We are inheritors of a long line of a family curse, if you will, right? And each successive generation's responsibility is to try to come to terms with that particular curse. And by the way, news alert, every family has them. And we all have family curses, and our family was treated to the reminder of a curse we have just last night at Chinese dinner. It was such a pleasant, lovely dinner before we went on to the Christmas concert, and we were literally put on stage and reminded of the family curse by our loving daughter, Arabelle, who was just serving, she was speaking as a prophet, and we didn't like it, and we almost ran her out of the restaurant, but she stayed. But it's, you know, it's this generational dysfunction that we have to contend with, and we have to deal with, and we have to somehow come to terms with. And a lot of what we deal with, much of it is of our own doing, but some of it is not of our own doing. We are having to manage the curses of our fathers and grandfathers and mothers and grandmothers. We're having to clean up their mess, just like our children are going to have to clean up ours. And so it's this interesting, dysfunctional thing that happens. And we have to come to terms with this particular curse, that specific dysfunction, to try to break its spell. And as those of us who are parents were forced to be made aware of the ways we pass our sickness onto our kin, onto the people that we're responsible for. And that's the thing about sin. It's always systemic. It is always systemic. It's always part of a system. Sin abhors a vacuum. And when sin becomes systemic, it becomes evil. I understand evil as both the cause and effect of sin. And so, one way or another, it will find its way to spread its tentacles into the other areas of our life. In this sense, then, evil isn't merely systemic, it's systematic. It finds its way, it moves with deliberate force, often via the paths of least resistance, like a river through a canyon. And before we know it, we're dealing with a whole phylum of cause and effect, of way leading on to way, like a disease spreads, or a rumor spreads, or a lie spreads, that winds itself like a river back into our past to some mysterious source that, if you reach back far enough, goes back to these very stories in Genesis. This is why these stories are so crucial, because if you follow the thread long enough through your family, you will reach Joseph and Jacob and Isaac and Abraham and Eve and Adam. This is our story, right? This is the story of the human condition. This is our origin story, not just of the Jews or even of Christians. This belongs to humanity because this is the origin story, right, of the human condition. So quite often, our motivations for doing what we do in this life is based on some unconscious guilt or some subterranean anger or unresolved injustice or wrongdoing that was done to us or a parent or a grandparent. And so we become not only repositories of this curse, of this brokenness, but we become conduits, active agents, unintentionally often, that carry it on to others, into our own progeny. And this, if we miss this dynamic in the Joseph story, we're not paying sufficient attention. We are talking about generational dysfunction. We are talking about systemic evil. We are talking about things that are passed on from son to daughter through father and mother. And if nothing else, the story of Joseph illustrates the importance of healing, of openness, of awareness, which often comes at the behest of good therapy. So shout out to all the therapists in the room, right? It is what we need. And therapy, as we all know, is just a fancy term for wise and thoughtful conversation. But we have lost the art of conversation, so now we have to pay professionals to talk to us and let us talk to them. But this is often how we break the curse. But we break the curse one way or the other by paying attention to it, by understanding what it is, by confessing it, by seeking somehow some form of reparation. So that's the dynamic that's happening in the early part of the Joseph story. That Joseph, in many ways, is responding to something that was out of his control and that is a part of his own father's guilt. And who knows if the father, Jacob, felt the need to love the youngest son because he, Jacob, was the youngest son and somehow he had ripped his own son. I mean, it just gets so messed up and so confusing. So now we're going to skip entirely chapter 38. Isn't that a relief? We're making progress through the Bible. And we're going to skip it because it doesn't belong there. No one has a good explanation for it. It's a total non sequitur. It's Judah and Tamar, and it's just this weird story that doesn't belong there. So we're just skipping over it. So see you later, chapter 38. What it is, Von Rott tells us, is the case of inserting a story from another tradition in the place that seemed the most innocuous. Well, this is part of a tradition. We got to fit it in somewhere. Where should we fit it in? I don't know. Fit it in after Joseph is sold off to the traitors, because we know that Jacob's really sad, and this will make it feel even longer. His sadness will just sort of, it'll be a little intermission. So chapter 38 is an intermission. So we pick up Joseph's story in chapter 39. Oh, or maybe not. There's breaking news. All right, so go with me. It's not up on the text, forgive me, but I'm going to start reading from chapter 39. When Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, Potiphar, Pharaoh's chief officer, the commander of the royal guard, and an Egyptian, purchased him from the Ishmaelites. Is that what I have up there? No, it's not, is it? No, okay. There, bango. When Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, Potiphar, Pharaoh's chief officer, the commander of the royal guard, and an Egyptian, purchased him from the Ishmaelites who had brought him down there. The Lord was with Joseph, and Joseph became a successful man and served in his Egyptian master's household. His master saw that the Lord was with Joseph and that the Lord made everything he did successful. Potiphar thought highly of Joseph, and Joseph became his assistant. He appointed Joseph head of his household and put everything he had under Joseph's supervision. This is quite a move, isn't it? It's a pretty nice little, what's that called? Promotion. Yeah, I've never gotten one, so I forget the word. From the time he appointed Joseph head of his household and of everything he had, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's household because of Joseph. The Lord blessed everything he had, both in the household and in the field. So Potiphar handed over everything he had to Joseph and didn't pay attention to anything except the food he ate. And then the end of chapter 6. Now Joseph was well built and handsome. Mm-hmm. Isn't that lovely? It's very important. This guy is not just a winner, he's a stud. Right? Old Joseph. So this is fascinating. We'll just read those first 6 verses of chapter 39. Joseph's story, when we're introduced to it, is one of intense hardship. He's hated by his family, almost killed, but instead sold off in slavery, only to end up in the employ of what will become Israel's arch enemy, Egypt. So it's nothing but bad to worse for Joseph in the first part of the story in chapter 37. It's nothing but just terrible stuff that happens to him. When all of the sudden, after our little brief Judah and Tamar interpolation, it's suddenly nothing but sweetness and light for Joseph. Nothing but success and admiration and promotion. And notice Joseph's favor in the eyes of the Lord extends even to Potiphar. This is blessing by association. Another incentive for us to hang around the right people. Right? Because their lives that are a blessing may actually become a blessing for us. Their blessedness might rub off on you. So what do we make of this? Well, I think we make several things from this interesting turn of events for Joseph. That Potiphar's house is blessed, but note, for Joseph's sake, not for Potiphar's sake. Potiphar's house is blessed for Joseph's sake, to make Joseph's life better. But it is nonetheless blessed. Potiphar's house now, I mean, we hear he's like, he had nothing to worry about except what to eat. Isn't that lovely? I mean, not a care in the world except what he had, what was coming for dinner. And this is what I make of it, that God is not a partisan. That God is not a Republican or a Democrat or an independent. That just like there is collateral damage, there is also collateral blessing. And that people who may not deserve it will get blessed anyway. Just like those of us have to deal with our family curse, and we had nothing to do with it. And yet we dealt with it. Well, sometimes we get blessings we had nothing to do with. We just happen to be the happy participants of this blessing. A faithful Christian can be a blessing to her entire workplace. If you are a faithful man or woman of God, it may very well be that you become a blessing for the place that you work, even if your place doesn't deserve it, particularly your boss. But you can become a blessing for them. A Christian spouse can be a blessing for his entire family. You can be a blessing to your children. You see, God's blessings, it seems to me, are prolific. They're generative. They're fertile. They overflow their intended boundaries. They are life-giving. That's what it means to have a blessing by God and to be a blessing. I'm reminded of Frederick Buechner's definition of a saint. A saint is not a moral exemplar. A saint is a life giver. Saints are life givers, he writes, and to be with them is to become more alive. And we shouldn't take this lightly. What this means for those of us who are seeking as diligently as we can to follow Christ, what this means is we can bless other people simply by being around them. We can be a blessing. And I want to add here that I think that that's not only a gift that's been given to us, but it's an expectation. That it's a responsibility. We have a responsibility to be a blessing to others. We have a responsibility to manifest the love of God. Why? Well, because God has manifested his love in us and to us and through us. Just like we are never mere repositories of the family curse, but conduits for it, we are never merely repositories of God's blessing. We are conduits of God's blessing. We are never freed simply from something. We are always simultaneously freed for something. And I think it's worth asking ourselves, and I was reminded of this when I was looking at, Jen and I were trying to decide what movies to go to, and we really want to see the Tom Hanks movie about Mr. Rogers. And I started looking at some old videos of Mr. Rogers when he was given a Lifetime Emmy Award at one point, and then he was given another award a few years later, and in both cases, it was interesting, 5 years apart, he does the same thing. So I'm going to do it with you. I'm going to get all Mr. Rogers on you for a second here, all right? Because if he can get away with it, I certainly can try. We're both Presbyterian ministers, right? And we're both close to flawless. So here's what he did, and I want to do it to you. So in front of this whole huge auditorium of, you know, famous actors and actresses and all of this, he says, and I'm not going to try to attempt to do his cadence and his voice, but he says, close your eyes for a second. And so work with me. Close your eyes, but you need to open them when I tell you to open them. And think of the people in your life who have been a blessing to you. Think of the people who have been a blessing to you. Just for a second. And as Mr. Rogers says, I'll watch the time. I'll look at the time. So now we are to be grateful for those people, right? You can open your eyes. Every one of us in this room has at least one person, if not a multitude of people, who have been a blessing to us, who continue to be a blessing to us. And not only should we be thankful for them and be grateful for them, but we should keep in mind that if we did this with your friends, they would probably think of you. So what does it mean to be a blessing to others as we have been blessed by them? So saints aren't moral exemplars, they're life givers. But note this too. Saints can earn the wrath of those around them if those around them are life takers. Life takers don't like life givers. Life takers want to remove life, and life givers do just the opposite. This is why prophets are a threat to power. Because people who seek only power seek to take our lives away. And we didn't need Nietzsche to tell us that. That if you are taking power, you are lusting after power, that means it is imperative that someone else get weaker. You are a life taker. And life takers don't like to be around life givers. Tolkien talks about this. Lewis talks about this. Any great story or sort of ancient mythology talks about this. People who are life takers are people who keep score. People who have agendas. We talked about this a few weeks ago. It works both ways. Saints and prophets, martyrs and apostles all have this in common, that they cause a stir wherever they are. Wherever they are, they cause a stir, either for better or for worse, depending on who they're around. And they cause a stir not because they seek power and control or are just loud and seek expression. Anyone can get people's attention. Just look at the YouTube celebrities. Any idiot can get your attention. I think of the Dolan twins, who I've been introduced to. They're funny, I admit, Belle. In this age of self-expression, anyone can get your attention. And we know, don't we? Don't we? We know the people who just want attention. But that's not what I'm talking about. These people who draw attention to them are divine disruptors. Prophets. That's what a prophet is, a divine disruptor, the world's whistleblower. That's what draws attention to them. I think of Harriet Tubman. Another great movie about her that's out and I want to see. I think of Martin Luther King. I think of Robert Billet. Remember I said that DuPont would get its comeuppance? Robert Billet, who Mark Ruffalo plays in the new movie Dark Waters. True story about this man, Robert Billet, an attorney who takes on the chemical giant DuPont because of their conscious, deliberate poisoning of a town in West Virginia for over 50 years. It is so heinous, so unbelievable, so incredible. And the reason the movie could happen is because they couldn't get sued because they were telling the truth. And I thought, Well, was DuPont run out of business? Hardly. And it turns out, I mean, this wasn't part of what I was going to say, but I'm just going to say it. The chemical that DuPont came up with is now in 99% of all human beings on the planet. And it's a chemical that causes cancer. Now, it doesn't mean that we'll all die because of DuPont, but it has literally infected everything. If you've ever eaten something cooked off of Teflon, you have the chemical inside you. So if you have Teflon stuff in your kitchen, get rid of it now. It's not too late. Anyway, this movie, Dark Waters, Mark Ruffalo plays Robert Billet. And it comes from a story in the New York Times. The New York Times broke the story, and it referred to, this was the title of the story, The Lawyer Who Became DuPont's Worst Nightmare. But to the people of that West Virginian town and to the rest of us, Robert Billet is a saint, a man whose tireless efforts, as it just so happens, continues to this very day. Robert Billet is still alive. He's still representing the people from that town in West Virginia because DuPont assumed that they would just be able to eventually exhaust the man because they would just keep, and he is not giving up. He is still alive. He's still representing one family at a time, and they keep getting larger and larger awards. He is going to single-handedly, if he can, bring the company down to its knees. So to them, to the people in power, to the people who have much to lose, saints are evil. They're devils. They're terrible. But to the rest of us, they're saints. They're life givers. I think again of 1 Corinthians 2, right? The foolishness of the gospel is what saves us. And the very things the world admires are the things that are going to be used as its downfall. Everything is turned on its head. As a saint, as a simple follower of Christ, it just so happens that Billet is a Christian, and this is brought out in the film. And it seems that we all are, force for good, if we're truly following Christ, and that strikes people one way or the other, as a blessing or a case. And in Potiphar's, a blessing or a curse, and in Potiphar's case, his household was blessed because of Joseph. They were in a place to receive his blessing as such. They received it as a blessing. And one of the things I like about this is that, like we said at the beginning of class about how evil is ultimately systemic, so too are blessings. Blessings are systemic. So too is Christ's love. So too is Christ's God's providence. So too is goodness. The darkness may surround the light, but it cannot overcome it. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness will not put it out. And I think of Robert Billet as the light in the darkness, and DuPont will not put it out. It can't. And so is Joseph. He is a light. No matter the darkness thrown at him, he continues to shine, and shine he will, as we'll see in the next ensuing weeks. He continues to shine. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. But there's one more thing I want us to notice before we end this morning. 10:20. Note the number of times that we read that Joseph was blessed by the Lord. 6 times in 6 verses. We read he was blessed. He was blessed. Oh, by the way, did you know that he was blessed? Potiphar's house was blessed because of Joseph's blessing, and it was blessed, 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 blessed. So if hate is the word that comes out in the first part of Joseph's story, blessed or blessing is the word that comes out in the second part of this story. And one of the things that this tells us is that it is entirely possible to go through a series of hardships and tragedies, years worth even, but this doesn't mean that God has abandoned us. Some of you have gone through weeks, months, years of struggle, of suffering, of injustice. It doesn't mean that God wasn't there through it. It doesn't mean that God abandons us. And here's, to me, this is not a small truth. Where was the Lord when Joseph was hated by his brothers? Where was the Lord when Joseph was beat up by his brothers and thrown into the pit? Where was the Lord when Joseph was sold into slavery? Was he just hiding? Did he not care? Or worse yet, maybe he doesn't really exist. Where was God then? And is it possible, and I think it is, with this eminent crowd, because I challenge my students to do the same thing. Is your religious imagination deep and wide enough to consider the possibility that those hardships were part of God's plan for Joseph's life? Now, bear with me for a second, because I know I could have just committed one of the grievous sins, which is to get all touchy-feely about sin and evil. And so work with me here for a minute. Let me ask the question again, and then I will qualify what I mean. Are our religious imaginations deep and wide enough to consider the possibility that the hardships that Joseph faced were part of God's plan for Joseph's life? Okay. What I don't mean to suggest is that all the hardships of our life are part of God's plan. I'm not suggesting that. I think a lot of the hardships of our life are due to family dysfunction, are due to our own choices that we make, are due to stupid things that happen. I mean, so I'm with you on that 100%. I don't believe that, but I also don't believe that all hardships are simply just, you know, the work of the devil. That there's just simply the cause of some dysfunction in our lives. I don't believe that. I don't believe that all of our hardships are just God's grace disguised, but I don't believe that all of our hardships are simply due to the devil, to evil at work unhindered by God. So think about this. I'm trying to qualify this, and it's worth wrestling through for a minute. I don't believe that just because God's presence isn't obvious that means he's abandoned us. After all, Joseph had those dreams, and they were prophecies. They were prophetic dreams. After all, he was loved by his father more than anyone else. And Joseph may never have found his brothers in the first place back in chapter 37. Now, this is the part I want to end with because I think this is crucial and it's so incredibly easy to miss. And I'm just so grateful that the Holy Spirit, I'm assuming, helped me understand this and helped me see this, because at this point, Von Rott was not helpful. He's been helpful everywhere else, but not here. Remember that tiny little throw-off line in the first part of the story where Joseph gets lost and a stranger says, "Hey, what are you seeking?" And Joseph answers, "My brothers. I'm looking for my brothers." Joseph never would have found his brothers if this mysterious stranger hadn't shown up and said, "No, they're over, just over that hill, just over that mountain. That's where they are. I saw them the other day." Isn't that, what a funny coincidence. This stranger, unnamed stranger, shows up and sort of directs Joseph on his way. And this is what I find so fascinating. So, in the midst of Joseph's struggle, if he were paying sufficient attention, God was still blessing him with prophecies, with the love of his father. Then he blesses Joseph in the strangest way with this mysterious stranger who asks this question, "What are you seeking?" And Joseph's answer, "My brothers," betrays a deeper purpose that even he didn't understand at the time. Because at the time, though his brothers may have been his brothers biologically, or at least his half-brothers, they were actually, and more importantly, his enemies. So he would eventually find his brothers, and they him, but not in the way he thought, and certainly not in the way he or they planned. Yes, on one level, he found his brothers. But really, what he found were his arch-enemies, who threw him into a pit and then sold him into slavery. He would find his brothers in the only way he could, in the only way that they could move from enemies to brothers, by going through the very things Joseph did in the story. And I think we hear over and over and over again, 6 times in 6 verses, that the Lord blessed Joseph to remind the reader he never abandoned Joseph. He was always there. And just in case it seemed a little scant in terms of evidence at the early part, I am just going to bulldoze you with the fact that the Lord loved Joseph, that the Lord was blessing Joseph. And so I'm forced to confront this story and wonder if all of these events weren't somehow part of God's providence. That maybe we can explain them on the one hand as partly the cause of some family dysfunction that is true and real and good, but is it possible that certain things in our life, in our lives, have two explanations? That maybe they're a cause of this, but also in some way, maybe somehow they're part of God's providence. His brothers never would have become his brothers had they not been forced to bow down before him. And he wouldn't have gained this position over them had he stayed with his father Jacob. It never would have happened. He had to be put in a position to be in power over them, which could only happen if he had been enslaved. See how strange it is. It's so weird. It's something you can only see in reverse. You can only see it backwards, right? And there's a term for this in theology. It's a German term, Heilsgeschichte. You can only see the history of God in your life when you look in reverse. You can never see it ahead. You can always only see it behind, which is why over and over and over again, the most common refrain in the Old Testament from God is remember, 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 remember. So he found his brothers in the only way he could by going through the very things he did. And we'll see that they do eventually become his brothers in more than blood only. They become his spiritual brothers when he's put in power over them, when the prophecy is fulfilled, and he's had his chance to extend his love and forgiveness to them. So I end with this story, and Jen gave me permission to say it. Sometimes the things we struggle with are answered in ways we never expected, in a way we never would have designed or figured out. Spells sometimes have to be broken. Generational dysfunction sometimes have to be overcome and defeated. Lines have to be transgressed in order to be redeemed. For Joseph to truly find his brothers, he needed to be sold into slavery, and they needed to be forgiven by him to find what he was actually seeking. What are you seeking? And so for us, God is asking us the question, what are you seeking? Because the answer to what you're seeking may not come the way you had hoped or wanted or expected. So for years, my wife, Jenna, struggled with her relationship with her mother, Hazel. From the moment I met Jenna, her relationship with her mother was fraught with all kinds of generational dysfunction, all kinds of misunderstanding and of just all you, we all know it, right? The kind of the sort of dark and pernicious lines of family dysfunction. And Jen could never win, could never get close to her mother in spite of all her efforts. And I watched Jen for years try to reach across that Rubicon to kind of make amends with her mother. And it was never, ever, it was never able to happen. And we had many conversations, long conversations, about how Jen eventually would just need to let her mother go. Just let her go, because constantly being around her is toxic. And it's bad for your own family. It's bad for your marriage. It's bad for your kids. You've just got to step back and let go. And it was very hard, and it was tearing Jen up inside. By all appearances, the many prayers we had prayed for restitution for her and her mother, the many hopes that we had for some kind of reconciliation with her mother, were dashed. It just wasn't going to happen at all. All of that possibility was gone. It looked like God had simply given up, or maybe worse yet, was never really listening in the first place, or maybe didn't actually exist at all. But then, in a way none of us would have designed or imagined or expected, Jen's relationship with Hazel was quite miraculously, and I use that word advisedly, quite immediately, absolutely, irrevocably changed in one instant, in the course of 24 hours. in the course of a day when Hazel had a massive stroke. She was hospitalized and quite literally brought to her knees, which was a place Hazel never would have gone if it had been up to her. That was one place Hazel would never go, is to her knees in a posture of dependence. Hazel was the one everyone else depended on. That's how she understood herself. So anyone who didn't need her didn't love her, and she didn't like being around people who didn't need her. Her daughter didn't need her, but her daughter loved her. Didn't equate with Hazel until Hazel had her stroke. And we were on vacation. We were in Las Vegas when we found out about it. We were just finishing up our summer vacation of 2018. And heard that Hazel had the stroke and was in the hospital. We got home a day or two later, and Jen immediately went to her mom. And I can say, and Jen and Belle are my witness, since that day, they have not had a single crossword to say to each other. Not one. It has been a 180-degree turn. All of our prayers have been answered. All of our hopes have been fulfilled. Jen and her mom enjoy the sweetest relationship they have perhaps ever had. Now, her mom's forgetting stuff. That's what happens when you have a stroke. But she's still cogent and lucid and can still talk. And it's wonderful. And it is this restoration so that Jen doesn't have to be at the funeral of her mother in the midst of that brokenness. It truly was a miracle. Now, we could call it sheer coincidence. We could call it dumb luck. But the eyes of faith tell me that it's a miracle that happened in the most unexpected way. None of us would have thought to pray, "Oh, Lord, would you please just give Hazel a stroke?" But we learn this, don't we? We learn this if we read Mark Twain. We learn this if we read Flannery O'Connor. We learn this if we read Charles Dickens. If you read A Christmas Carol. Sometimes people need to have the scared out of them. They need to be pimp slapped by God. They need to be completely upended in order to find their blessing. If we can learn anything from Joseph's story, it's this, that God works his will in mysterious and often inscrutable ways, often in ways that seem to indicate his absence. But he never actually leaves or abandons or forsakes us. He may remain hidden for a time, but never merely to punish, because his love is always in order to restore, and God's punishment is his love. It is his providence. It's always restorative. He means to have us redeemed, but if he has to crack our head to do it, if we have to go through suffering for it to happen, then so be it. So I think, at the very least, this is part of what the story of Joseph tells us. Any thoughts? I want to get out of here unscathed. Yes?
Well, just last week, forgive me, I forget the quote. I forget you said it. It was great. As I said, I want you to print these things out.
Sorry, right. C.S. Lewis.
The greatest faith comes from people that have gone through the fire.
Yes.
Have had huge problems.
Yes.
And pain.
Yes. Indeed. That is really almost the only way faith grows, is through suffering. It almost doesn't grow any other way. It grows a little bit through success, but it really grows, you know, Kierkegaard's faith sees best in the dark. Or C.S. Lewis's, the alternative to tragedy is damnation. I mean, it becomes kind of like this hidden conspiracy. Oh, that the way we are blessed is by being broken. The way that we have the blessings of God manifested is through the suffering. And I've told this story before, but it helps us to be just gobsmacked in the face over this reality. And I've shared the story with you, and I'll just make it quick, of Jerry Sitzer, our family friend, who lost his whole family in a terrible car accident. Remember that story? And Jerry Sitzer wrote a book called A Grace Disguised. And just for those of you who haven't heard it, he homeschooled his kids, and he and his wife were taking their three children. I think it was three children that they had to a potlatch, or was it four children that they had? Four. They drove them to a potlatch in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, because they were learning about Native American Indians. And on the way back from that, and his mother happened to be visiting that weekend too, so he brought his mother along, and a drunk driver hit their van, and all in an instant, Jerry lost his mother, his wife, and his daughter. Three generations of women, three generations of females, he held them all in his arms as they died. Well, you don't recover from that ever. The only way you make it past that is through it. And a year or two later, it was a miracle he hadn't died, but he had other children, and now he's happily remarried, and it's a beautiful story that he has, and he's been voted most inspirational professor at Whitworth 15 years in a row. I mean, you can sort of see why the pain he had to go through. And I don't suggest for a moment, by the way, that God ordained this accident to happen. That's not what I'm suggesting at all. But what happened to Jerry's faith was that it increased in a way it never might have before, that God made the most awful, terrible thing in the world turn out in the strangest way. And I have Jerry's permission to say it because he says it himself. It was a grace. This is Jerry talking now. You can't gainsay a man like Jerry who's lost what he has. He said, you know, it became a blessing. And he had this dream every night after the accident that he'd be running. It was a dream he had every single night. He'd be running to catch the sun that was setting behind the mountains. And every night his dream ended the same way, with himself falling flat on his face, dirty, and the darkness has overcome him. And that's what he's running away from. And one weekend, a year or two after the accident, shortly before he began writing his book, his sister came to visit him. And his sister, they had a good weekend that weekend together. And that night, Jerry had the same dream, and he's running across this desert, and the night is catching up to him, and the sun is setting behind the moon. But suddenly, unlike any other night, his sister was standing there, and she stopped him. And Jerry looked at her like, what are you doing in my dream? And she said, Jerry, what are you doing? What are you doing? What are you running for? And he said, I'm trying to catch the light. I'm trying to run for the light, and I can never catch the light. It always overtakes me. And she said, Jerry, the only way you're going to catch the light is by running into the darkness. You'll catch the light on the other side. You'll never catch it running this way. Jerry never had the dream again. And he was able to begin writing this book. So the healing happens not by running away, but by running through. Yes. Well, you should. It is. It's not only, this is why I brought up Mark Twain earlier. It's not only Tom Sawyer's story, it's Huckleberry Finn's story. It's amazing, right? And it's our story. It's our story. Okay. I went over. So we'll see you next week, and we'll just have to contend with the first service again, but we can do it. I believe in us.